So, our last class. Happy dance. Less of a happy dance. Exam 3 distribution. Got posted solutions on the web. Same drill. You should look at the solutions. You should look at your exam. You should think about what that means. If you have questions, if you think that grading's not right on something, submit it for regrade, etc. You can do that really right up to the final if you want. I mean, so if you catch something while you're studying for the final and you want me to look at it, that's fine. Okay. So many of you, of course, are concerned about how the grading thing works, and one of the messages that I've tried to convey to you is that the mean was a bit low here. So where you are relative to the mean, if you're here, I would worry, okay? But if you're on the mean, the fact that that's a 55 and the last one had a 70 something for mean, that you don't need to worry about. And I've tried to explain why in the syllabus and a couple of other times. So I'm going to try a little bit more right now because I happen to know that this is something that some people in this class historically get aggravated by, and what I find is it's because they actually don't understand what I'm doing. So I'm going to try to convey to you what it is that I'm doing and why. So there are a few facts about this. One is we have 4 exams, and I let you, in principle, drop one, right? Or I have an algorithm that calculates it out, and it will calculate it dropping each of your exams successively. I've given you an algorithm, and, you know, so I may wait the final a little bit more when I drop one. But the point is, you can have a bad day, and in principle, that one goes away. The problem is, if I do that, if the exams are of unequal difficulty, you can imagine what it would feel like if you happened to be sick on the day exam 1 was given, when everybody else in the class did pretty well, because on the scale of things, that was a relatively easy exam, relatively little new material. Okay? So that would really not be so fair. I have to do something that takes into account the differences and the difficulties. Part of the problem with the exam that you just had, rotation historically is a bit tough for students first time through, and there was a lot of material. So, I mean, it was, from your perspective, a harder exam probably than exam 1, and that certainly showed up in the mean. The mean's a little lower than I was expecting. That also happens because sometimes it just boils down to the way I word a particular problem. It seems okay to me when I look at it, and I don't actually look at the exam that we just took, exam 3, and think that there's a problem. But many of you had serious problems, especially the last problem on the exam. So there was something about it that was a little bit harder than I had actually intended. Okay? So that happens. So that means there's no way around the fact that the means are going to vary. I aim to put the means at 65 or 70 because that way I feel like I can get evaluations of students who aren't really getting this stuff so well, so I can tell someone who ought to fail the course from someone who should be getting a solid C. And I have enough headroom that I can tell the difference between a student who really is in the B range and a student who really knows the stuff very cleanly. Whereas, for example, if the mean is up at 85, I lose that discrimination. All right, so that's why I try to put the mean where I do. It's not just to frustrate you. Okay? So that said, I have to do something to even out this difference so that on the scale of things, you don't get an advantage in particular if you drop one exam versus another. So let's sort of look at an example of the algorithm that I use. Let's look at 3 different students. One on the lower end of the mean on all the tests, one on the median, and one on the high end. Okay? And so I'm just saying, you know, for this example, let's just say the mean of this is 83, 57, 50, and 60, and the students make these relative scores. Okay? What is it that I'm going to do? So these are the scores, for example, that I made this up, so this doesn't correspond to the means that you had for your 3 exams. But We are at the point in the semester where we haven't had the final exam yet, but you have basically your scores and the mean for all three exams. So what happens to those to try to even them out? There are a couple of ways I could do this, all right? One way I could do this, and I imagine you've seen this in many classes, I could, for each exam, make a letter grade scale and tell you what is an A exactly, what is a B, what is a C. And you could carry that so you know if you made a B on all three exams, you could expect a B in course, okay? Because of the way that I'm trying to basically use this algorithm to allow you to have a bad day, I don't like doing that so much. So I give you a sense of it. I say, if you're on the mean, you're doing all right. That's probably about a B. If you're way above the mean, you're doing better. And if you're way below the mean, you should work. That's basically the message I want you to get for each of the exams. The algorithm I use to try to measure them, to sort of do this, takes advantage of the fact that you are a large, hardworking class. And so I assume that on average, you guys are going to do a good job for me. Okay? So that means if the mean is really low, then probably I made the test too hard. If it's really high, I probably made it too easy at some level, and I'm not getting... So I'm sort of assuming that you're doing your job. If you were a small class, I couldn't do this. Okay? But you're being a big class, you are. So what that means is how you should interpret your performance in each exam really is relative to the mean. So what I do to normalize things out is I take basically these all four distributions and I put them so that their means are at some numerical value. I choose 100 because that way all of them move up. It doesn't actually matter what the number is, but if I put it at 70, some move up and some move down, and you guys all get pissed off at me if I move it down. But it's not actually arbitrary, and it really doesn't matter. But that said, I find that I can't get through to some students about that, and they're angry with me. They say arbitrarily normalize down the grades. That's not true. So anyway, everything is getting normalized up. So I take all these distributions, and I effectively normalize them so that their centers are at 100. So what does that mean? That means that every grade for exam 1 gets scaled by 100 over the mean of exam 1. Every grade for exam 2 gets normalized, gets scaled, gets multiplied by 100 over the mean of exam 2. So what does that mean? It means this one gets multiplied by a smallish number, this one gets multiplied by a bigger number. Okay? So that simply takes into account the fact this was easier than that one. You okay with that? I need to ask questions because I don't want you thinking there's something shady in this normalization. I want a chance to explain it to you. Okay, if you think about it, this does sort of make the scale, sort of the numbers, sort of arbitrary, right? Because I'm now not on a 0 to 100 scale at the moment. What this means is, for example, the highest possible score you could have after I do this normalization would be if you managed to make a score of 100 on the exam that had the lowest mean, right? Then, when I scale that number up, it would fall at 200 on this scale, okay? And you say, wow, that's way out there. Well, that's okay, because that student did a perfect job on the hardest exam. So, yeah, they're way up there. Make sense? All right, so all I'm doing is setting them so that their centers have the same value. Once I do that, then what that means is when you get your grades in Blackboard at the end of the semester, when everything's said and done, you'll have a column which is the grade you scored that you saw on your test. Then you'll have a column which I will call the normalized score for that exam. And for exam 1, for example, Bob's grade of 53 gets scaled by 100 over 83 and it becomes a 64. It's kicked up because I'm normalizing, I'm taking this whole distribution and sliding it to 100. Joe's score, which is right on the mean, becomes 100 because that's where I'm setting the mean. Sally's score of 97 is quite high, and it gets scaled up and becomes 117. For exam 2, I do the same thing. Bob's score of 40 becomes a 70. Note here the difference. Here I'm dividing by the 57 mean. Over here it was 83. That's because this was a harder test. So this one gets divided by a smaller number. So the relative change of Bob's score from 40 to 70 is larger here because it's a more difficult exam. Joe's score is again on the mean, and Sally's score goes way up. Sally, again, you say that's 130, that's high. That's because Sally did very well on a much more difficult exam, so it gets kicked up. But the relative position of each student with respect to the mean on that exam stays the same. So now that I have taken out to first order the differences in the exams, I then use those numbers in this algorithm, and that's what these normalized scores are what go and count in here. Okay? And then I weight them according to these percentages along with your labs and your problem sets. And then that gives me a number, just a number. I then make a distribution of those numbers, having taken your best of these four schemes, I take your best number. I make a distribution. I don't even know what the number range is here at the moment because having done all this normalizing and everything, I now just get numbers. They're all mean something relative to one another, but the absolute scale doesn't mean anything. So this doesn't sit at a 0 to 100. It's some other scale. But it is a clean distribution, and it represents the distribution of your averages calculated accordingly. And that is the distribution where I put the letter grades, okay? And just for your reference, because people do ask, I don't have a quota system historically in this class. If I look back what has happened in the past, generally you're a pretty good class, and I recognize that this isn't meant to be a weed-out class for anything. So I tend to center the mean at a B. And it's a pretty broad distribution for the B. So generally speaking, roughly 50% of the class lies within the B range, B minus to B plus. Roughly 20 to 25% of the class usually lies in the A range. And roughly 20 to 25% of the class lies in the C range. And if you're off this distribution, I feel like I have some freedom to look and see what I think you're actually getting out of the class and decide whether I want to give you a C or C minus or failure. Okay, that's the way it works. I don't feel like I have so much freedom when you're up in the distribution. Okay, once you're in the distribution, I sort of look at the distribution. I happen to know some of you pretty well because we've talked a lot and I know what you know. And I use that to help confirm my thoughts about what I think you should get grade-wise. And I use that to sort of help me decide exactly where to put these lines. But once those lines are drawn, because this is all relative and everybody's in that distribution, you're fixed. So I don't play games after that. Any questions, comments, worries? Now's the time. Is the normalization idea clear, what I'm trying to do there? Yes.
So when you say that that each score is the same distance from the mean score, does that mean that the curve is the same shape, essentially?
No, the curves will be different shapes on all three exams. I mean, the literal Gaussian curve that you would hope for and describe will be a little different. And if I wanted to do a bit of a finer correction, I would worry about the width of that, okay? And I ignore that. And I think I've known at least one professor who tried to take that into account. I don't know if they still do it. He was an organic professor.
It doesn't make a big difference in terms of the whole process.
Well, I don't do anything with that. I just basically take the whole distribution, slide it so it's centered on one number, take the other distribution, slide it, and put it on the same number. And the fact that one might be a narrower range or one might be a wider range, I don't worry about. But that would be a second order of that. Okay? All right. And all of this information you'll get. Okay, so I might as well tell you now. when you hand in your final, I'm going to tell you to go away, and I'll get back to you. You don't need to email me asking anything about it, right? Because, actually, it turns out you'll be done on the 18th. I think my TAs may have an exam on the 20th, so we may not even get the thing until the 22nd. And I'll have visiting family, and I will try to get them out as soon as I can, but I have submitted grades on the 24th before, so that's the problem with class time is the exam. That said, when I submit them, I'll probably send you a note saying grades are in. Don't worry about it yet, because I have to give you all the information. So within Blackboard, I will put all of this information, and you need to check it, okay? And it's at that point that if you need to talk to me about grades, do. But that's, you'll get it all, okay? So you'll understand what the normalization was. You'll get this distribution, et cetera. Yes?
How does the lab grade come to
my grade? I get handed the lab grade, and I factor it in as whatever it was, the percentage. In this case, I told you it's 16% of your grade. So if they tell me it's a 92, then they will come in with a 92 will come in with a 16% weight. And I don't think about it beyond that, unless there's an issue. So if you're missing a lab, and this does happen for some of you, for example, if you're missing a lab, I will probably not catch that at this point, and it'll get factored in accordingly, which may mean your lab grade is really bad. This is why you have to check everything, because you may find that, in fact, you did do a lab, and there's a paperwork screw up, and you have to let me know, and then we'll straighten it out, and if I need to change your grade, I do. Okay? But you have to check that. Anything else? All right, so I hope you're comfortable about it. But now you can see why you might not be super happy if you have a 45 here, but it may not be the disaster that the mere number might do the thing, okay? Because the distribution is sort of centered at 50. All right, so we were talking about waves, and one of the things that we were talking about last time is if you have a wave traveling on a string, that when it hits a point where it is fixed in, that in fact you get a 180-degree phase change for the reflected wave relative to the incoming wave. And this sort of has to be that way because this is a fixed point, which means the reflected and incoming add together superposition. They interfere, and they have to interfere destructively, so they have to come in with opposite signs in order to have that point fixed where it is. So upon reflection at a fixed end, you have a 180-degree phase change. You have no such thing if this end basically is free to move. All right? So what we looked at last time was a superposition on a string where we have a wave traveling on the string and we superimpose it with a wave that's reflected. And we actually took the wave equation for those two waves, we did superposition, which is we mathematically added them together to get the amplitude for one wave plus the other wave, and we asked what is the mathematical addition of those two, and when we regrouped it using trigonometric ID, we got this equation. So this equation describes y, which is the amplitude of the thing on the string. It will change with position as I move up and down the string this way, and with time. And you get this sort of strange double harmonic function, one harmonic in time and one harmonic in space. And this is a very interesting sort of thing when you group it this way, because what it means is that you get fixed in space something that's periodic with the wavelength of the wave on the string, and you have the amplitude of that varying in time, which is why you end up with these so-called standing waves, which aren't plugged in. Okay, so you get these standing waves happening. Wherefore, certain wavelengths, you have the reflected wave and the traveling wave interfering constructively, and you get this fixed pattern, right? And as I change that wavelength, you'll get different patterns. So as I'm changing the wavelength here, k is 2 pi over the wavelength, right? You get a different pattern in this string. And if you notice, where you have a big amplitude there, sometimes it was 0, sometimes it was flat, right? Sometimes it was a very large amplitude. And that basically is the time dependence that's in here, which is also harmonic. So where it's big, it's called an antinode. Where it's fixed, it's called a node. Right? And this phenomenon, it's known as standing waves. And of course, as Jubin showed us with his bass last time, it's really the principle of how stringed instruments work. So violins, cellos, basses, pianos, etc. And you can actually, or from the characteristics of the string, which has a certain tension, a mass gradient, length, and the length, you can calculate what frequencies will play well on the string. And those will be those frequencies where you get basically the idea of resonance, that is, the traveling wave and the reflected wave will interfere constructively and give you the large amplitude motion. If they interfere destructively, you don't get much. So the other wavelengths sort of interfere randomly along the string, and that's why when I was changing his wavelength, between the patterns, you would get sort of this random jumble. So you can get that on any string if you pluck it, and that's not a very clean note. The ones that are clean notes are the ones when you can excite these particular resonances, because that's when you get the large amplitude. And we'll talk a touch more about it today, but large amplitude corresponds to large energy flow, which is what you interpret as energy, as intensity. So intensity goes as amplitude squared. We'll talk about that in a few minutes. So to be quantitative about it, though, there's sort of a pattern you go through, and it's really not too bad, but you have to get used to it. Suppose I have a string of length L, has tension T, mass gradient length. I would like to determine what are the frequencies that would resonate on that string, at what notes would it play well. And you can do that by saying, well, suppose I have something that's fixed at each end that has an antinode in the middle. That would be the longest wavelength that will play cleanly on this string. And we call it the fundamental. In music, it's the fundamental frequency. It's the lowest frequency that will play very well on that particular instrument, that particular note. So if we get that when L is equal to lambda over 2. So I draw it like this, and this is sort of a half lambda, right? The full lambda would be like that. So this is a half lambda. So the length here has to correspond to lambda over 2 to play this. If you have the length corresponding to 2 times lambda over 2, or 1 lambda, you get that sort of thing, and now you have 2 antinodes and 1 node. If the length corresponds to, there's 1 wavelength and here's a half wavelength, so that'd be 3 lambda over 2, then you get this excitation. And these are called overtones or harmonics. This would be the first harmonic, the second harmonic, etc. And if we want to know what the frequencies are that correspond to this, the first thing to do is to basically write this. This is how you think your way through it. And you can see the pattern. You only have to go 2 or 3 before you see the pattern. In this case, for each of the higher harmonics, and you can, in principle, go up to an infinite number of nodes and antinodes, the length must correspond to an integer times lambda over 2. And the integer is 1, 2, 3 on up. Those are the excitations of the string that work well. If you want to know how that works in terms of frequency, because this is in wavelength, then the velocity of the string, which is determined by these things, goes as the frequency times the wavelength for each of these different frequencies, which means the frequency goes as the velocity over lambda. So the n, here's lambda basically for n, and I can substitute in for what I can substitute in this for the velocity here, and then for lambda n, I use this, right? There's lambda. So 2L over N is lambda N, which I substitute in right there. Right, so this equation tells me the frequencies that will resonate on the string. And we use frequency because that's how we refer to what the pitch is that you hear. High frequency would be a very high pitch, and low frequency would be very low. And I believe frequency, remember, has units of 1 over seconds, and I believe human hearing sort of ranges between 20 and 20,000 hertz or something like that. We'll actually see that in a minute. Is it okay with that? All right, so there's another type of problem that you see like this. This would be a stringed instrument. We also look at tubes, a wind instrument. And for a wind instrument, you basically are looking at longitudinal standing waves in a tube. And so visually, it's a little harder to look at than it is to visualize what's happening with a string vibration. What happens with air in a tube is it moves longitudinally, right? So you actually have a vibration like this, back and forth. If I close this in, then that vibration gets truncated. So you can think of that as a node, a displacement node, we would call it. If you think in pressure feet, that corresponds to the lowest pressure because the air effectively can escape. And so that would be a pressure antinode. Yeah, this would be a pressure antinode. You get lots of particles there. I actually think it's least confusing to think in terms of displacement. If you run across a book, sometimes they'll present it in terms of pressure, sometimes of displacement. But if you think in terms of displacement, it sort of corresponds to what we're doing with streams, and it's easier to think through. So I think of it this way, and I basically think of large amplitude, that is antinodes, to correspond to large displacements in terms of vibration. And so in terms of the boundary conditions on the tube, where you have a hole, you're free to have displacement, therefore you should have a big antinode. Okay? So that's how to think about it. So a kind of problem you might be given is, suppose you have a tube that's fixed at one end, and you have vibrations inside that tube. What notes or what are the frequencies that will resonate in that tube? Antinodes where you have openings. So I can draw the first one would be like this. I put an antinode here and I have to have a node here. And I draw the least number of nodes and antinodes I can get away with. So that would be like this. That corresponds to 1/4 of a wavelength. Right, because to get a full wavelength I have to go and then come down and then go back up. So that's 1/4 of a wavelength corresponding to L. The next step would be where I put a node in there. I have an antinode here, and I have a node there. And the next step I can do, the next simplest thing I can do, is to draw something like this. Now L corresponds to a half plus a quarter, so 3/4 of a wavelength. Here it's a full wavelength plus a quarter, so the next step up, I have another node in here, is 5/4 lambda. So now, the way it works is that L corresponds to N over 4 times lambda, and N is equal to 1/3 odd harmonics. And I can then play the games, the velocity of sound, 343 meters per second, 20°C. The relationship between frequency and lambda is like this. I can now substitute in for lambda in terms of this expression, and I find that the frequencies go as n times d over 4l, where those are my integers that are allowed. And those are the frequencies that would resonate. So one point in all this is that in both cases, you might have environmental dependencies. So here, for example, the speed of the sound varies with temperature, which means this number varies with temperature, which would mean that for given characteristics of a string, you'll actually get different frequencies depending on just the temperature of the air. In addition to that, you might expect expansion and contraction of various components of whatever instrument you're talking about, and that will change also with barometric pressure, with the ambient environment, temperature, pressure, and humidity, and things like this. So if you've ever been curious as to why it's important to spend time fiddling with your instrument and tuning things so that you get the right notes, that's why. You want to warm it up, and you want to tune things in order to get the proper frequencies out. Okay, if you're a plug-in chugger, I want you to understand that's not a fundamental equation. That only works for this setup. If I give you a different setup, different boundary conditions, you have to derive a different equation. So the kinds of problems that get asked are, what are the frequencies played? And you have to go through these steps. Okay? Any questions about this? Okay, so we talk about tuning up an instrument, and it turns out that there is a way of one way in which you can help tune an instrument is using a very interesting optical phenomenon called beats. For beats, what I'd like to do is to take what we know about waves, and I want to assume that we have two waves that are passing through the same region of space, and they differ very slightly in frequency. The frequency difference between them is very slight. Okay, the wavelengths are almost the same. Let's say that they have equal amplitudes, and let's let them have the same beginning point, so the phase angle is the same, but we're not going to worry about that. So, mathematically, what do we do? Well, we write down, here's one wave, it has an amplitude, and we'll use sine, we could use cosine, doesn't matter. Kx minus omega t is a traveling wave, okay? Let's just say that we're looking at one spot, let's define ourselves to be at x equals 0, that's where we put our ear, okay? So the equation for this will be a sine omega 1t. I have a second wave. It goes as a sine omega 2t for all the same reasons, but now omega 1 and omega 2 are very slightly different. I then use superposition. This is the thing that makes waves special, in a sense. I can add them together. So what I actually see at x equals 0, what I hear, happens to be the sum of this wave and that wave at every moment. So I simply add them together. So I add together these two signs, and now I take advantage of some trig ID that I pull out of my butt, and okay, so there's a table or whatever, and you look it up. The sine of something times the sine of something else equals 2 times the sine of 1 half, the two somethings added together times the cosine of 1 half times the difference between the somethings, okay? Nothing fundamental in that, I mean, unless you're a mathematician or whatever. To me, it's a useful thing that we just find and we use to make the mathematics work. So in this case, I don't have an intuitive feel for what's going on with the sum of these two signs, okay? I add them together using this, and look what we get. Yeah, you look at that, and you've got that intuitive feel, right?
No, just kidding.
Let me lead you through a little bit. When I add them together, okay, I get a sine times a cosine. This one is the sum of the two frequencies, and this one is the difference in the two frequencies. This really is the frequency average. These are very close together. So basically what this says is you hear the average frequency of these two waves, and then you multiply that by something which is an amplitude times this term. Note that this term is a harmonic, and it's a harmonic that changes in time with this frequency, which depends on the difference of the frequencies. And remember, that difference is very small. So if I have a very small frequency difference, or if I have something that has a very small frequency, remember, it's very slow. So although the oscillation you might get in the air, that is the frequency you hear, is a high pitch, you can think of this term as giving you an amplitude that will vary slowly in time. And it will vary more and more slowly the closer those two frequencies are. So I have two tuning forks here with boxes that will make them a little louder than normal. So they're supposed to give you the same frequency. You okay with that? What's a tuning fork? It's a piece of metal that does this. As it does this, it wiggles the air molecules in a way that you get these longitudinal waves coming out. That's what you hear. Okay? Now what I'm going to do is I'm going to put a little bit of weight on one of these tuning forks, which means it's going to wiggle a little bit slower. Depending on where the weight is, it'll wiggle a lot slower or a little slower. That's basically a way of changing the frequency you hear. All right, so just to remind you, here's what it sounds like without anything. All right, now I can change it quite a bit. I'm going to put this up at the top. Are you able to hear it? Can you hear it back there? Okay. So you can see I can change the frequency a little bit by putting this thing on there. So the first thing I'm going to do is I'm going to put it down here. And when it's down low, the frequency won't be that different. So it's almost what it was. So now I have a situation which is sort of what we're talking about. I can produce two waves that should differ by a slight amount in frequency. Now I want to do them simultaneously. You hear the average frequency, and the amplitude, which is the intensity you hear, varies in time with the frequency that is that frequency difference between these two things. If I make that frequency difference a little bit bigger by detuning this one a little bit more, you're going to hear that change, right? If omega 1 minus omega 2 is a bigger number, you have a slightly higher frequency for the modulation. I detune it a little bit more. It's just more of an effect. Now you can almost not hear it. Okay. Is that cool or what?
Yes.
All right. Now, I imagine there are a number of musicians in here, but let me ask you, I know at least one. Can you use this to tune your instrument? So what you would look for, if you have a string and you think you know what its pitch is, you can adjust the other string so that it has exactly the same frequency. If you can hear the beats, you adjust it until the beats effectively go away. That is, the frequency difference becomes so small that the time between the oscillations of that cosine becomes very large. You don't hear that modulation anymore. Yes.
There's actually like this debate over there are different ways of tuning, and one of them is that way, the other there are different methods of tuning. It's not like exact spacing of notes, and like it's like this big historical argument. So like not everyone is like that.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. So no doubt I'll oversimplify anything in the musical world, I can tell you that. Did you have a comment?
Yeah.
Guitar, okay, that's great. Alright, so I might be able to do something with beats, but I have no idea what the pitch is I'm trying to get, I'm sure of that. So, anyway, this is very cool, and so this just goes by the word beats. You can actually do the same thing with any sort of wave. You can do it with light, okay? We work with water waves if you set up a situation such that it could be done. Okay, so we've talked a bit about amplitude and energy. So what I'm not going to do is derive for you sort of how energy flows in a wave. What I'm really just going to say is that the power of energy that passes a point as a function of time, or the power that passes a point, will go as the velocity of the wave, as you might imagine. If you have more wave passing, then you'll have more power. But it goes as the amplitude squared. Okay, so this turns out to be pretty important. So for example, suppose I have a source that's vibrating or creating light, it doesn't matter, whatever kind of wave, all right? And that energy now goes out. So you can imagine sound, I have a firecracker that goes off. That energy will go out in a spherically symmetric pattern. So I take the same energy, and what does the energy mean? Remember, for a simple harmonic oscillator, you have 1/2 kx squared is basically the energy that's in the oscillator. So the particles in the air are executing simple harmonic motion with 1/2 k amplitude squared. So that's why the energy goes as amplitude squared. I guess that is sort of the derivation of it. I take the same amount of energy that's propagating out in this wave, and it gets divided over a larger and larger area. That area grows as the area of the sphere, right? So it grows as 4 pi r squared. So that means that you are, if you look at the energy per unit area that is flowing through any given area on the sphere, that has to drop as 1 over r squared, because you're dividing by the total area that the energy is divided to. The energy flow in a unit area is what we define as intensity. It's what you hear as the intensity of the sound. It's what you see as the brightness of light. And that will drop as r squared. So now this actually is something very quantitative. If I have a candle and you're up close, it may look very bright. If you move twice as far away, it will look 4 times dimmer. Okay? With sound, if you're at a concert and it's too loud, if you go twice as far away, the intensity will drop by a factor of 4. Alright? Very practical thing to learn. Or you could just stuff popping in here, but any questions on that? Okay. So we're talking about sound. So I want to do a little bit with that. Okay, so energy flow really is what I'm thinking of as power. So intensity is equal to the power per area, which is in watts per meter squared. So the intensity of sound is in watts per meter squared, but when we use it, it turns out that we use a system of relative comparison. So we define a reference intensity for for practical world applications, okay? And this turns out to be 1 times 10 to the minus 12 watts per meter squared, which is important because for your average person, whatever that means, this is the threshold of hearing. So I'm sure that if many of you who may be destined to become doctors, you will spend much of your career understanding the fact that every person is different. So I'm not quite sure what it means when you talk about average person. But nevertheless, it's a useful quantity. It is true that if we had something that could emit a certain intensity of sound and we ask 1,000 people, tell me when you can just hear it, and what this says is, in principle, we would get about this number. Okay. So sounds in the practical, in the real world, are generally measured with respect to this in a unit system of units called decibels. So we say that beta, which is the decibel, the beta in decibels, the unit of that is usually dB, is 10 times log base 10 of I over I0. So it's a logarithmic scale. So something is, I'll give you some things that you can use to sort of get a sense of it. So this means at threshold for human hearing, if you're an average person, it's at 0 decibels. Because log of 1 is 0. Right? A whisper is around 20 decibels. Street traffic is around 70 decibels. A siren at 30 meters is about 100 decibels. And note, the distance is important, because if you're at 60 meters, it's 4 times less than 10. A rock concert at pain threshold. And those are the good ones, right? So this would be the kind where your ears are ringing the next day. This would be about 120 decibels. A jet engine at 30 meters, and I don't know whether that's probably idling, is 140. My guess is it's much higher when it's getting ready to take off. Okay, so just to give you some sense. So that's how you measure intensity for sound waves. So just to give you a bit more of a feeling for this kind of thing, if you go out and you buy an amp for your electric guitar or your get a stereo system, one of the things you might look for would be what's known as flat frequency response. Okay, so that's basically saying that you'll get an even intensity distribution across all the frequencies. So if we do an example, let's suppose we have a stereo that gives you an ad. It says that you have a flat response within plus or minus 3 dB from 30 hertz to 18,000 hertz, which is roughly the human hearing range. So what does this mean? For the relative intensity variation. So what I'm really asking is, how much does the intensity vary across that frequency range that you hear from the high pitch to low pitch as the system plays? So the variation is going to be roughly plus or minus 3, so we're just going to say 3 decibels. So beta minus beta 1 is about 3 dB, and that's going to be equal to 10 times the log of I over I0 minus 10 times the log of I1 over I0. So we're just going to compare frequency 1 to frequency to the unsubscripted frequency. So if I have the difference in logs, you can divide one by the other, right? So this becomes 10 times the log of I over I1, which tells me I can now solve for I over I1. It tells me that the intensity of the one frequency over the other is equal to 2. So that plus or minus 3 dB variation means the intensity over the frequency range can vary by as much as a factor of 2 and still be within what they're claiming for the advertisement. Earthquakes are waves. You ever been in an earthquake, anybody? Where? Where were you? A big one or?
No, like four.
Okay. I've been in a couple of nice ones. I was in the Loma Prieta earthquake in California, and there were lots of funny stories, and not funny stories. Lots of stories that came out about that, but earthquakes tend to have a fairly slow variation, and they have a number of different frequencies, and some pieces are longitudinal, some are tandem, so there are interesting ways that way. But I had a friend who was sitting in the third floor of a building and literally watched the wave come across a field and then hit the building. You know, it's like, that's got to be pretty strange. Anyway, so earthquakes are waves, et cetera. So there are lots of waves in the world. There was a hand up. Yes?
What is this to you represent?
If I solve this equation, I get this ratio is equal to 2. So this is the intensity of one frequency, this is the intensity of another frequency, so it's just telling you that the intensities can vary by as much as 2 and still have you within 3 dB. So there's a couple of other little wave things I wanted to show you. As you see, once we sort of have the fundamentals of waves down, there are a lot of pretty amazing phenomena that we can discuss. So I mentioned to you the acoustics at one point, how there's sometimes dead zones in auditoriums if they're not designed well. And I'd like to talk about that for a moment. Imagine that I have a source of sound here and another source of sound, and let's say that they're in phase, so they play the same frequency, the same with the same time, okay? And let's say that I'm some distance away, so we'll say that this is a distance R1 and this is a distance R2. If this distance is the same, then it means that I am the same number of wavelengths away from the source for each of them. So that means that when one wave meets with me and another wave meets with me, they'll basically have the same motion as they get to me, right? The same phase, we call it. same argument of the sine function, because it's the same distance in the same time. So that means that they necessarily would hit me and interfere destructively. They'll always add together. So here we'll get destructive? It'd be constructive interference. And in fact, this will always be true even if they differ by a full wavelength. So if R1 minus R2 is equal to an integer number of wavelengths, then I will also have constructive interference. Does that make sense? What's going on? The way you can think about it is I have one wave traveling and I have the other wave traveling, and the question is, what do they do when they meet each other at that point? So if they start out in phase, if they effectively go the same distance or a distance that is different by one integer of a wave, by some integer number of wavelengths, they will always be constructive. So that means the amplitude will be large, and you will hear an intense thing. In fact, it will be more intense than either of the waves together, will be twice the amplitude. In fact, it will be four times louder. If R1 minus R2, this distance, is equal to, how does it work? They have to differ by half a wavelength. So in lambda minus a half, then you'll have destructive interference. Make sure I got that right. That means that you'll hear nothing because they continually cancel each other out. So here are the two waves. If they go the same distance, they add together. If one of them differs by half, they cancel each other out. So if the difference between them is an integer plus or minus a half, then you're going to have destructive interference and won't say anything. So a classic example that we use is called a double slit experiment, or it's basically this kind of experiment where I have, say, a speaker here and a speaker here. Now, these each produce waves that literally go out like so. The other one produces waves at the same frequency that goes out like so. And let's say that I have drawn for you sort of the wave crest for each wave. And what you'll see is that in many places, say here, 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 the wave crests add together, which means you would hear it being very loud at those points. But there are other places, for example, here, where I have a wave crest hitting where this other thing is at a trough. So you'll hear it have destructive interference here, 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 etc. So what you'll find is that you'll have sort of areas where they add together and areas where they go apart. And it just has to do with the relative distance from each of these two sources. So you can do the same thing in water. What we have is called a wave tank here. Thin layer of water with glass underneath, and I have a bar that's going down with a certain frequency. Okay? And what you see are sort of the waves going, because in places where the wave crests are, it's thicker water and you sort of see a shadow. So this would be a flat wave source And now what I'd like to do is to create sort of a single source of waves instead of this flat bar. But I can do that by putting things in here that stop the waves except for a small opening. And now you see that that opening basically gives you a circular wave front or wave coming out, so it's like a firecracker or whatever if this were sound waves. And now what I'd like to do is to create two of these and look for this effect. Now can you see it? Right here, you can see sort of regions where it's a bit darker and regions where it's a bit brighter as these two wavefronts hit each other. Are you able to see it? You might be a little bit better if I do this. Oh, that wasn't what I wanted to do. If you're looking, you sort of see striations here. And those are sort of the interference patterns of this wave. So you get the same thing with sound, for example. And because it depends on the wavelength, and the wavelength depends on the frequency, this will be frequency dependent. Which means if I have an interference pattern set up for one frequency, those positions will change for different frequencies. So what you may find is that you'll find a certain position in an auditorium where certain frequencies are dead to you and other frequencies are good if you have this kind of effect going on in an auditorium. Yes?
Point out on that diagram again, I can see that occurring in there. Like, which regions are destructive and which are destructive again?
If I pretend that these are the crests of the waves as they pass through each other, where the two crests meet, you would have constructive. This isn't particularly well drawn. If it were well drawn, these crests would all meet and they'd actually form a line, which is sort of what you actually are seeing here. Generically called interference, and again, all waves will do it. And it's one of the things that makes them pretty special. You can do this with light also. So the last sort of wave phenomenon that I wanted to mention to you is something that you've all heard before. If you're standing by the side of the road and you're listening as cars go by, what you hear is something like, right? And if you're a redneck like me and you go to the racetrack, it's like, as they go by, right? That's what you're hearing. So what is it you're actually hearing? It's not like somebody's driving along and they have a little switch and they go, oh, I see somebody up there. I'm going to have my engine up a little bit of high pitch, and then as they go by, I'm going to turn it down, right? But that's what you hear. Right? High pitch to low pitch. Siren, if you listen to a good Hollywood movie. And then low pitch. Alright, that phenomenon is known as the Doppler effect. And it's a fun thing. There are lots of applets online, and it turns out that I didn't find the one I was really wanting to, but let me Did I blow it? Alright, we're just going to do this. Doppler shift applet. So when you do this, you'll find lots of things. Some of these are better than others. I have no idea what this one looks like. It was done by a guy at Davidson, so it's not a bad one. All right, so now imagine that I have a source of sound, and what you see are the crests of the amplitude as it's moving as a wave. If it's not moving, you have an object that is vibrating and emitting sound with a very particular frequency. That means the wavelength is fixed as it goes out in all directions, okay? And the intensity drops off as 1/r² just because this whole area is that. But in terms of the pitch that you would hear, it would be the same in all directions. If this object is moving, then let's say it vibrates this way and the wave starts to propagate out. In the meantime, this thing vibrates this way again, that wave propagates out. If I'm moving, that wave is propagating out, but in the time it propagates out, I'm moving so that when I vibrate that way again, that distance is a little shorter. Which means when it hits your ear, those wave fronts come a little bit closer together, and that means you would hear a higher pitch. So visually, if I now make this source move to the right for you, you can see that what happens is that in the direction, if it's moving toward you, as these waves hit you, the distance between the wave fronts is less. That is, the wavelength seems shorter, the frequency would be higher. The pitch is higher. If it's moving away from you, you have the opposite effect. The distance between the wave fronts is larger, the frequency is going to be lower. So when the car is moving toward you, moves away from you, and that change in the pitch happens right as it goes past you. If you hear it honking, you're probably a little close to the road, so you want to step back. Okay, so quantitatively, because that's what we're all about here, I could derive this for you, but I think I'm just going to give it to you. The frequency that you hear, if the source is moving toward you, is going to be equal to the frequency at the source. That would be if the source were still, if you were in its rest frame, divided by 1 minus the velocity of the source over the velocity of the wave. The velocity of the wave would be speed of sound if this were sound, for example. Okay? So if it's moving really fast toward you, then this number becomes something substantial. 1 minus that becomes a substantially smaller number, and this frequency becomes higher. The frequency that you hear becomes higher than the frequency of the source. And if the source is moving away from you, the frequency you hear is equal to the frequency of the source divided by 1 plus the velocity of the source divided by the velocity of the wave. So you can use the Doppler shift to measure the speed of blood going through an artery, for example. You can bats use it to send out sound in a sense, they know what the sound is they're sending out, and then they detect the sound coming back, and part of the information they get is the frequency shift, which tells them their relative motion with respect to what it is that they bounce the sound off of. Okay, so the question is, what happens when the object travels faster than the wave? And that actually can happen. For sound, for example, if you go supersonic, you're going faster than the 343 meters per second or whatever it was through the air. And we do certainly have planes and things that can do that. So, rather than, I don't know if this particular Doppler, this does it, I hope it does. Yeah, it does. Then the object outruns the wave, and what you get is literally the wave comes off at an angle. And it's known as a shock wave. So if you, they outlawed it. When I was young, we used to have these big explosions that would happen every time some military aircraft would hit the sound barrier. They're called sonic booms, and if they happened to make a mistake and decide to gun it too low, they would just bust all the windows in a small town or something. So that's why they started outlawing it. But it's a big shockwave. It's like you have nothing else, and it's a very intense thing. Because they actually, I mean, I have it going awfully fast right now, but if I slow it down just a little bit, you basically get this bow of pretty intense stuff happening. So that's sort of cool. Anyway, that's a shockwave. Occasionally you can actually see really fabulous pictures they can take of a supersonic plane in flight where you literally can see optically the shockwave coming off the bow of the plane, the bow of the plane. You can have the same effect as in light as well. Actually, it's called Cherenkov radiation when you get emitted. But let me talk for a moment about sort of the optical effect of the Doppler shift in light. Light is a wave. So it turns out that you can tell that objects are moving away from you or toward you by the frequency of the light if it gets shifted. We know, for example, that hydrogen emits a spectrum of light that comes off at very particular frequencies. If I take that same hydrogen and I put it in a star and that star is moving away from me, then those frequencies, that whole pattern, gets shifted a little bit to the red, a little bit to lower frequency. If the star is moving toward me, it gets shifted a little bit to the blue, a little bit higher frequency. So if I integrate over a bunch of stars, I have something called a galaxy. Okay? And it turns out in the 1930s, people looked out and they looked at all the various galaxies that were out there and started looking at the optical redshift, the optical shift of the patterns of frequencies that were produced by the atom, that is the light. So you take a fixed frequency of light that or pattern that you know about on Earth, and you ask, where does it show up in terms of actual frequency or color when I look at this galaxy? And when they did, they actually found that all the galaxies, effectively, are moving away from us. And the farther they are from us, the more they're moving away, the faster they're moving away from us. The shift becomes bigger and bigger. Which is a bit of a puzzle. You can imagine that you have bread dough with raisins in it, and you let it rise. As it rises, raisins started far away from each other have a lot of air that goes in, and they move away from each other fairly fast. Raisins that are close together move away fairly slow. So the fact that you can look out there and you find all the galaxies moving away from us is basically the signature for the fact that we live in a universe that's expanding, and this was the birth of the idea of the Big Bang in cosmology. So it's from the optical redshift. So, okay, I guess I should quit there. Any questions? All right, so I think we're done. If you want to pick up your exams, they're up here in 5 or 6 of the folders that are arranged by your first letter, last name.